All right. First, what did you work? What was your position when you started working on the parkway?
Well, you have to go back 100 years or so. In 1931, mm-hmm. I was in school at Chapel Hill and left and came home. I was born and raised in Waynesville, North Carolina.
Okay.
Born April 30th, 1914. Graduated from high school when I was 16 years old. Went to Chapel Hill 2 years. Went to summer school at Duke University at Lake Junaluska, North Carolina. Four quarters at that time. Mm-hmm. And I went to work for the State Highway Department on January the 1st, mm-hmm. 1932. Mm-hmm. I worked for the Highway Department for 6.5 years. During that time, someone conceived the Blue Ridge Parkway. Who conceived it originally, I do not know. Roosevelt was looking for something to do with people. He started the CCCs, and that was took care of a lot of young people, but it really didn't prime the pump, the economic pump. So the conception of the parkway, primarily it was for the purpose of putting people to work, and mm-hmm. Roosevelt, of course, went into office in 1932 as president, thinking he was going to be able to complete the parkway during his term of office. Nobody really had the conception of the magnitude of such a construction. At that time, it was to have run from Front Royal, Virginia, to Soco Gap, North Carolina. The two people that I was, well, in the first place, I owed my job in the highway department to a commissioner who was named Frank Miller, who lived in Waynesville, North Carolina. At that time, the highway department only had 5 divisions. Mm. At the present time, there's 16 divisions. Mm-hmm. Each division has a commissioner. Mm-hmm. Mr. Miller, Miller, mm-hmm. was a commissioner. The man I was working for at that time was named Byron Marsh. He was from Onega, New York. He's a graduate of MIT and was probably one of the better highway engineers that's ever been. Somewhere along the line, whoever in North Carolina decided that he would... Well, let me go back a minute. Okay. North Carolina and Tennessee were at odds as to which way the parkway was going. North Carolina wanted to go from Mount Mitchell all through the place it is now built.
Right.
Tennessee, of course, wanted to go over to Clingman's Dome. And, of course, North Carolina won the battle.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Miller and Mr. Marsh. Mr. Miller had a great big house in Waynesville. He lived there as he was a loner. He never was married.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a large boarding house, which was not in use at that time. And so they stretched out a bunch of tables in the dining room and took coastal geodetic survey maps where they were in existence. And selected the gaps that the parkway was to traverse through the state of North Carolina. Who did it in Virginia, I do not know. Anyhow, it's due to the terrain and the inaccessibility of the location of mountains. Of course, the vista was the main object, and they had to get high to get it. And the way to get to the heights, in some instances, posed quite a problem. As long as you had to enter wherever there was an existing road or some sort of a logging road or mining road or whatever. In North Carolina, from Wagon Road Gap, which is between Brevard and Waynesville, was the last major road that was in existence at the time the parkway was built. There was one other road that was which is now Route 15, mm-hmm. going through Hardy Gap. That from Hardy Gap, the 215 runs from Rosman to Canton. Mm-hmm. And the gap was, Hardy Gap was between those two places. The next gap, the next major entrance was at Balsam Gap. Mm-hmm. The next entrance was at Soco Gap. Mm-hmm. So probably the most difficult problem they had in access to begin the building mm-hmm. was between Wagon Road Gap and Soco Gap. Soco to Balsam was the most difficult because it was highest and had almost no access. Mm-hmm. The major accesses, go back a minute and start over, okay. over at, say, Spruce Pine. Mm-hmm. From Spruce Pine to Ashland, you had several access roads that made it possible to build a large portion of it, but in the section around Mount Mitchell, mm-hmm. There were two camps of contractors, successful bidders on the contract mm-hmm. between Mount Mitchell and Oteen. Mm-hmm. Two of the contractors built camps on the site,
okay.
which required yeah. quite a bit of...
Yeah.
In the first place, it was too far to transport personnel and equipment. You had to have some kind of a place camping. Mm-hmm. I lived at a camp for 2 years. I was working for an LOL tier company mm-hmm. from Durham. We built several sections of the park ramp, getting a little off.
What was the name of that camp?
The number of the contract was 2N2, if that means anything to you. They started,
well, it will mean something at Parkway.
Well, the park, it was just, there was no name. I mean, you were in the mountains. There were some, for instance, that job started about a mile north of the entrance to Mount Mitchell from the parkway now. And it was about 5 9/10 miles long. Mm-hmm. The construction of the parkway, as I say, was necessitated by accessibility. Mm-hmm. In almost every instance during the first several years of construction, and actually on until World War II, mm-hmm. when World War II began, of course, all the construction was terminated, was stopped at whatever point it was. Anyhow, from Spruce Pine on to Oteen, we had the two unaccessible section of about 10 miles each, which required camps. Yeah. Tier had one camp, mm-hmm. and a firm, Basilio and Grogan from Roanoke, Virginia, had another second camp, closer to Oteen. Mm-hmm.
Tier.
When I first went to work for Tier, they had finished or were close to finishing three sections of the Blue Ridge Parkway between Grandmother Gap, which is just north of Grandfather Mountain, and Mount Mitchell. The Bureau of Public Roads decided that the people that were working for them had to be under civil service. When they took the examinations, the people that were working and aware of the mm-hmm. problems, on-site problems, did not pass the exam, so they mm-hmm. had people right out of school that were aware of what they learned from books, but they had no idea about what construction entailed.
Uh-huh.
So when they got ready to cross-section mm-hmm. the finished product, they didn't know how to do. Tier hired me to go behind them to check on whether or not he was getting paid for what he'd done.
Okay. So what was your position? What was
your position? I was called an engineer, and by the time I got through working with them, which was some 12 years later, I was chief engineer. They'd started ground roots and worked into one of the largest, probably the largest grading highway contractor in the United States.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me, Sarah, if there's anything. These questions are mostly for CCC or park employees. So really, you told me, just anything you have to say.
Well, I guess, let me look at my
notes
here.
Okay, that's fine.
I'll stop the tape for a minute.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Miller realized that they were not politically astute enough or had enough political power to sell this thing to anyone. What selling needed to be done, I'm not aware of, but the man who was head of the location department and was also quite a politician was named R. Getty, G-E-T-T-Y, Browning. He was chief location engineer for the highway department. The man who was the chief engineer for the Bureau of Public Roads at that time was named Spellman.
Spellman, yeah.
S-P-E-L-L-M-A-N, yeah, Spellman. Yeah. Of course, Marsh and Miller sold the idea to the highway department here, and he in turn sold Mr. Spellman on the location. I guess I'm getting mixed up a little bit in my train of thought, but anyhow, the parkway had a greater impact on the highway construction industry than any other thing for one reason. In the first place, in most states, in this state particularly, there was no highway department until 1932. They think that's when it was started. I haven't been able to run it down. Mm-hmm. But in any event, before that, the counties built the roads. Mm-hmm. At the time, the Highway Commission began taking bids on construction of the highways. Mm-hmm. Every yard of material that was moved was called classified material. You bid on rock and earth. Rock was determined by anything you couldn't plow with a plow. Well, most of the contractors would load the bid to their best interest. Right. If they thought there was more rock, they'd bid the rock higher. If they thought there was more dirt, they'd bid the dirt higher. So anyhow, in that instance, that became a classified bid when the parkway was let. In other words, if you were bidding on a job from here to Asheville, if it was classified, you didn't have to worry about how much rock. You just bid it, so much rock and so much dirt. When the parkway was let, all of the parkway in North Carolina was let classified, unclassified, excuse me, it was not classified. So it was the contractor had to walk every foot of the job he was bidding on to try to determine if how much rock was there. So you didn't work the dirt, you could move, push, and pull, and whatever. They had to get, they didn't survey it. They had the plan showing the depth of the cuts. But in no instance at that time did they make this, the Park Service or the Bureau of Public Roads make any effort to determine the amount of rock or dirt.
Okay. So it was completely the
So it contracted responsibility, and that became in later years, all of the most all of the states went to unclassified excavation. Now it's just that the rock is determined by sonar, all sorts of different methods. But at that time, it was a contractor responsibility. Another thing, at the time it was conceived, the parkway was determined by the the engineers, the rate, the percent of grade that would be adequate for a car at that time, and it was determined that most cars could not operate efficiently at a grade steeper than 8%, which is 8 feet per 100 feet. And it, where you had a real steep curve, of course, your grade was on the center line of the road, and if you had a steep curve, the inside of that curve got considerably steeper.
Right.
So they used what they call a compensating grade factor. Any curve steeper than a 10%, you had to take 1% of the grade off for each 2 degrees of curve of amount. Anyhow, the let me look one over.
All right.
job that was on the parkway, and I happened to be there when it was the most difficult. The drills that you used to drill the holes and what you put to dynamite to do the blasting were, you had to, if you can conceive a 5,000 foot high mountain with no access and up and down and straight some almost vertical. These drills weighed about, they were called wagon drills. They had steel wheels and steel frames that supported a drill that ran up and down on a boom. The boom could be it could be plumbed up. In other words, it would rotate up and back and forth in all four directions. But to get that drill on top of the cut, you've got a bunch, maybe five or six men in the drill crew. So you had two drills, which is what we had at the time. We had two drills, two old Ingersoll Rand drills that weighed 1,500 pounds apiece, two air compressors, and two air compressors would run four drills. So you had two crews. To get that drill up, of course, you had to just you had old chain falls and come alongs, and you pulled it up by from tree to tree, rock to rock, and you finally got it up there. And when you started drilling a hole, you'd drill a few feet or a few inches and then blow the hole out to get the chips out, dirt, dust. If you hit water, which you did a lot of times, even at higher elevations, the water would splice up, get all over the men, and in the wintertime, the clothes would freeze on. People were hanging on the banks wanting to go to work, so they didn't. They had to keep working.
I can't conceive of that.
Well, I'm getting a little divergent from what I'm doing.
No, that was one of my questions. What was the most difficult? Answering all my questions.
Well, the most difficult part, of course, was you couldn't take a dozer or a shovel, power shovel, into the areas because you couldn't, they were inaccessible. Right. You could take a dozer and push the rocks off that were loose, but when you started up and it was all hard, you had to shoot your way up, literally.
Yeah.
In some instances, you just drill a short hole and just make a bench for the dozer to get the overburden off. But to clear it, you had, in some instances, you had to tie the people by a rope to keep them falling off the side of the mountain and get the trees out of it. But,
were there any accidents?
Oh, yes, numbers, all sorts. Fortunately, for this job that I worked actually on four sections of the parkway in North Carolina when I was working with two.
Any of the workers died?
We never lost a person. Mr. Tierce's brother was killed on a job in Southern Virginia, I can't remember. Yeah. That was before I went to work.
Right. That was dangerous work.
Well, in the first place, the units that you used to haul the material, the dirt or rock, whichever, you could push the cuts in the fields were so close together you could usually push the dirt, but you wanted to save it to come on top of the rock so you could get it smooth. So you had to push it somewhere and leave it up in the hole somewhere and move it again. But the old hauling units were called AFY, A-T-H-E-Y, AFY wagons. They were on tracks. They were pulled by tractor. Crawler tractor. Those units, right under the center of these wagons, was a hydraulic lift that would lift the wagon up and dump it. Well, you had clevises on either side of it, so it would dump. If you had to close the clevises on this side and raise it on this side to dump this way, to dump the other way, you had to close it up. Lots and lots of times when they got ready to change the side, they'd forget to close the clevises in the wagon and go off over the hill. See, it wasn't attached in there.
We just had to go down, hook them,
you know, and pull them back.
Okay. What were some of the people you worked with like? Did you enjoy working with them?
Well, you know, let me go back to just a minute. I'll start with inception of this thing.
Yeah.
Well, in the way the parkway was, after it was, mm-hmm. see where it was going, the Park Service mm-hmm. had an engineer with what they call an ABNY level, A-B-N-E-Y, ABNY level. Mm-hmm. That level had a bubble on it. Mm-hmm. You could set that bubble, that ABNY, on any percent grade that you wanted to. In this instance, we were talking about the 8% bending maximum.
Right.
Well, in order to compensate, he would set that ABNY on 7%, and he'd start at each gap
mm-hmm.
and have a man with him. And all he had, as far as he could see,
right.
as long as that bubble was in the right place, he could, uh-huh. this guy in front of him would blaze the trees
okay.
and from a gap to mm-hmm. wherever.
Yeah.
The highway department in North Carolina, after that was blazed,
mm-hmm.
you had two things you had to determine. You had to determine the elevation
mm-hmm.
of the starting point. If you had a benchmark somewhere that was, most of the benchmarks, a lot of them in this part of the country, were already established by the Coast and Geodetic Park.
Mm-hmm.
I worked one summer
uh-huh.
in fall. I worked from Wagon Road Gap
mm-hmm.
by Mount Pisgah mm-hmm. down to the French Broad River. I had a crew of 6 men.
Uh-huh.
We would go by... We got an elevation. There was a benchmark at Wagon Road Gap.
Now, who had you said put those benchmarks up there?
The Coast and Geodetic Survey.
Huh.
Just a minute. Yeah. Cut that thing off.
Okay.
I'll make that back. All right.
You were telling me about, about the work that you were doing with the 6-man crew.
Well, of course.
How long did you live, you said 2 years in the camp, in those
well,
two camps?
By that time, everybody, well, let me, let's go
okay.
this way.
Okay, all right.
The highway construction industry
mm-hmm.
was, the people had, there was so little work going on, practically every major construction highway contractor in the South
mm-hmm.
was
right.
just a financial
right.
problem,
right.
severe.
Yeah.
When the parkway started, it was let in such small increments
mm-hmm.
that the competition was mm-hmm. terrific because all
yeah.
these people had equipment stopped,
right.
and I don't suppose there was a single project that I know of that a great amount of money was made except
mm-hmm.
on the job from Balsam, the first job between Balsam Gap and Soco Gap, and that was a long time after the thing was started.
Right.
When they started, it's hard to keep this thing
uh-huh.
in sequence.
That's
but if
fine.
You, when,
yeah,
they start, when they started letting the contracts
mm-hmm.
at gaps, they would only go as far as they had the money, let's say, to
okay.
build one. And most of them were in this part, in Virginia and
mm-hmm.
part of North Carolina, they could let 10 and 12 miles of jobs because they were less severe in their terrain.
Yeah.
And they had more dirt, which
uh-huh.
was moved at a lot cheaper price.
Mm-hmm.
But once that was done, it worked mm-hmm. out that Roosevelt, as I say, was going to build a thing during his tenureship. And actually, it was
uh-huh.
started then and wasn't
mm-hmm.
finished till the late 80s. Of course, most of it was before
uh-huh.
then. But anyhow, how the each ensuing president
mm-hmm.
had something to sell. We've got these little stretches of road
yeah.
stuck out here, and we got to go
mm-hmm.
and get them together. Well,
uh-huh.
so they led another section and then another section.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, I got to consult my notes.
Okay.
See what I'm getting.
All right.
Give me something that you can. One other person that I know still was active, and he had his name was Clarence E. Boone, B-O-O-N-E, Boone.
And you're telling me
somebody you might want to talk
yes,
to.
Yes, Clarence Boone. And where does he live?
He lives in Spruce Pine.
Okay.
His father and started a small, had a hardware store
uh-huh.
in Spruce Pine.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they were spruce pine. There was a lot of feldspar and mica.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that happened good in the parkway, when they came along building this thing, they had people right there that were familiar with the drilling and shooting rock, which made it nice for the contractor.
They did. Yeah.
But anyhow, Mitchell Distributing Company is the name of this company.
Mm-hmm.
Its main office now is in Charlotte, but Boone's father was one of the people that started. At that time, they sold small drills.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the drills were handheld drills, mm-hmm. drilled with a hammer and two men were twisting the drill. When they started, Parkway was started, Mitchell had sense enough to know they were going to need, so they started selling drill steel.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, on the job, to sharpen the steel, you had to have a blacksmith.
Mm-hmm.
You had to have a blacksmith forge. So around your camp, you had to have a blacksmith. You could bring this, every time a steel would break or get dull, you'd bring it in. He would get the stuff. He knew how to temper the steel, too, if you didn't do that. In order to temper it, you'd heat it red hot, make the points. Of course, you had a hole in the middle of it to blow the dust out. To make the points, then to get, he would cool it in oil, a mixture of oil and water. He put it in oil and then in water, and oil and then water, and get it to where it would harden it again.
Yeah.
In later years, the last few years, they started using detachable bits.
Mm-hmm.
A company here in Ashland, Rock Bit Sales and Service, were the first people they invented this thing.
Oh.
You could drill the bits, and they could be sharpened.
Right.
And finally, they used carbide inserts, and the insert would drill maybe umpteen feet, while a regular drill wouldn't drill maybe 5 or 6 or 8 feet, depending on how hard it runs.
Okay. And you were saying that Clarence Boone's family were the ones that were selling these.
Clarence, it was called Mitchell Distributing Company. Sparks, father-in-law, a man named Green, and a man, Boone, and Green started Mitchell Distributing Company.
Oh, okay.
Sparks lives in, he's the president of Mitchell Distributing Company. Now, he lives in Charlotte, but I don't think he could add anything to you.
But Clarence Boone.
Clarence Boone, all the contractors would get somebody that was familiar with the event to walk the projects with them. This Clarence's nickname is Duck, and I guess Duck's walked more of the Parkway almost as much as I have.
Okay, so he walked with the
He would go on, the contractor would have the plans.
Okay.
Clarence would take them to the site as near as they could get, and maybe if there's some place that you can walk through. To, in most instances, you climbed over the job with the plans to look at it, and then you climbed back to where you left to get out. So.
Okay, yeah. And he lives in Spruce Farm. Okay. You wouldn't happen to have his phone number?
I think I might. I'll
okay,
look
we'll look for that later. Okay, we'll find
out. No, I can't. Man, I talked to
him.
That's okay. He's
yeah, I can get it for you.
He's got a ready-mix concrete plant in Marion.
Oh, well, thank you for that. Yeah. Okay. Let's see.
Well, let me go back just a little bit. When you, after the your man, the Park Service man, would flag the job, and the state would come along, and from a point, you would establish the grade, the elevation.
Yeah.
The two things that you were only allowed 0.2 foot deviation in a mile in elevation, and 0.3 seconds of a degree per mile in this in direction to determine where you were in elevation. Of course, what we would do would take off from a benchmark, which was a bronze marker, and from that we would establish new benches from, for instance, from Wagon Road Gap to the French Broad River. We had a crew of men going on cutting out between the blazes, and then we would run benchmarks. You had to get the benchmark was usually a 20-foot nail in a tree close to the bottom. And you'd have to get it far enough away from the center line where it wouldn't be disturbed during construction. So that posed a problem.
Yes, that did.
So what we had to do, not having any more tolerance in that, we would run from gap to gap. There would be smaller gaps in that area. and then double back and run. We'd run benchmark marks and come back and check back on the old one we started.
Okay.
And we would finally get to lots of places where it really don't make it.
Mm-hmm.
But to get the direction right,
mm-hmm.
we didn't have our instruments were old. Mountain Girly transits, which didn't weigh 10 pounds, you know, they had couldn't weigh very. But to do that in daytime, you had to have a theodolite because you
couldn't see.
A theodolite is what the ship used to use to determine the direction. It's a heavy transit, but it's too heavy to carry around in the woods. In the first place, you can't got any place to set it up.
That's right, yeah.
So anyhow, using a Mountain Girly, you had to, from your little books that you had, you could determine Polaris is an elliptical, makes elliptical movements.
Yeah.
It has to be right at the top or the bottom of the ellipse. You could determine the time, you could get the time of day or night in which it reaches the ellipse. What we'd have to do, we would take our, when we came to a gap and we needed to check our direction,
right.
We would take the transit, and from the line that we were on, we would turn the due north with our compass, which was not very accurate. Where whatever direction it might be, would turn due north, and on that line, say we'd be at the top of a ridge or somewhere where you could see the North Star, and we'd set two stakes about 20 feet apart with a tack in one of them. We would have to get in the morning. We would have to get at night, sometime when it reached the ellipse, so that we could see it.
Oh my goodness.
We were working on the Wagon Road Gap section. We made 8 trips in the morning. Like it was ellipsing somewhere between 3 and 4 o'clock. It changes all every day. And we'd get up there. We'd leave Waynesville, where we were staying, and get up there, and it'd be foggy, and we couldn't see, so we'd have to go back. we couldn't see that small transit. We couldn't see it in daytime. So we had to keep doing that.
So you hoped it wouldn't be foggy or cloudy. Oh my, that's wild. Where were you living when you were doing that work in Waynesville?
Well, let me see. When I went to work with the highway department, I was getting away from the parkway.
Yeah, we want to hear.
With the location department for 6 years,
mm-hmm.
and during that time, I guess most of the major roads west of Asheville were located.
Okay.
For instance, there was no road from Balsam Gap to Silver except a pig trail. There was no road from Soco Gap to Cherokee but a pig trail. Bear trails were said. We located most of the roads. And when I went to work with Tier, and then later I was in business with the firm here in Asheville Contracting Company, which I was vice president of. Then later I started my own business. In 1955,
and what was that called?
Blue Ridge Structure Company. We built concrete structures, bridges, dams, whatever.
Yeah.
But anyhow, what was I talking about? What happened?
Oh, you were saying that most of the roads, like from.
Oh yes. Well, I was very fortunate when I went to work with Tier. A large portion of the work that we did in North Carolina, I had located roads. For instance, all the way from Mars Hill to Sam's Gap, we located that road. And went back and built it.
I'm a student at Mars Hill.
I know, you told me.
Yeah.
So you know, you said that,
I just wanted, I wasn't sure if I reminded you.
Let me see what else people.
Yeah, tell me about a little bit more about some of the people that you worked with.
Well, of course.
Were they from this area?
Well, not many.
Not many.
Well, all of the dealers, all the labor.
Mm-hmm.
You could just go pick up hundreds of people anywhere you were. Right. You know, you had people standing. The camp that we had, that we built, had it was we sawed balsam timber on the job to make, to build the camp.
Yeah.
We built six, let's see, we had three two-room cottages for the superintendent,
mm-hmm. yeah.
one for me,
uh-huh.
and then we had two for the Bureau of Public Roads employee.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, we had a large mess hall in a sleeping place for the operators.
Yeah. Okay.
The laborers got there best way they could.
Right.
I mean, they would go, maybe we'd have maybe 8 or 10 of them, and they'd have two or three old pickup trucks.
Yeah, I'd spoken to a laborer that worked up Rock Creek Gap,
mm-hmm.
and he had said that, yeah, that involved getting up at 3 in the morning and walking to a certain point, and then someone with a truck would pick him up, and that'd be another hour's drive.
Well, I can tell you a little story talking about tearing people going broke. I got married in 1940 at that time.
I was going to ask if you were married, didn't you?
Well, I lost my first wife.
Mm-hmm.
Married again.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Mr. Tear, I was living in the camp. We got married, and my wife was from Hendersonville. She was still at home.
Jesus.
He called me one time, told me that he didn't have enough money to operate very long. He wasn't going to owe anybody any money, so he wanted me to call him every night to be sure he had enough money to pay the employees, and I had to get somewhere and there was a phone. So I moved to Spruce Pine, and my wife and I rented a cottage over there. And I drive back and forth. Well, of course, after about just a few months, he got back on his feet to some degree, and I didn't.
He didn't need to be called.
Well, I didn't have to be called every day.
Yeah. Huh. What did your wife do during the day?
Well, she got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to fix my breakfast. I could eat lunch at the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd get home. I'd leave home at 4 or 4:30, and I'd get back home by 7:45. She'd have supper on the table. I'd walk through the bed and go back to work.
Oh, my. But you had your weekends off.
Worked 6 days a week.
Worked 6 days
a
week.
And I had to work 7 days
a
week. By the time we checked two men that I hired to work with me to help measure the quantities on the jobs that were completed when we started this job.
Yeah.
See, the only thing we were really interested in was the amount of material being moved out of the cuts, excavated. We didn't give a darn where it went.
Mm-hmm.
So we only had to take cross sections and reference points.
Uh-huh.
In other words, we were taking sections behind the Bureau of Roads.
Okay.
Well, the Bureau of Roads decided we knew about more about it than they did, so they sent somebody along, and they would they would copy the notes that we were making.
Wow.
So that worked out.
Okay, good. And let's see, you told me, you know, where you were born and that kind of thing. Any favorite stories or anything that you...
Well...
Anything especially... memorable. Everything's memorable. But,
well, of course, it's so really hard to think of what is my favorite story.
Right.
You were talking about the people. I'll go back a little bit. The man who was superintendent on the job that I went to work on was named John Wilkinson.
Mm-hmm.
And he was from Terracea, North Carolina, which is down where the tulips are raised.
Uh-huh.
And he just died a few years ago. Uh-huh. His name was John Wilkinson.
Mm-hmm.
We had a drill foreman there was named Cook.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to have a powder man. His name was Jared.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the operators I knew, of course, at that time that construction workers were really kind of a thing apart. I mean, they were not high class people.
Right.
Most of them liked to drink, and most of them liked to not work unless they had to.
Yeah.
But working the way we were working, and if they were in a camp, of course, they were more or less destined to stay there if they got a check or two.
Yeah.
But in later years, of course, the employees as a group changed remarkably between the Parkway construction mm-hmm. days and yeah. after war, uh-huh. then you got into the people that had been in the CBs right. or people that were educated yeah. to a greater degree.
Right.
For instance, when I left the Parkway, when we finished that job, mm-hmm. we had a whole bunch of old trucks on the job. Mm-hmm. We had what they call quarry skips. Mm-hmm. We had a truck with a boom on the back of it, and uh-huh. men would break them. You'd drill and shoot the rock in the quarry. We had to yeah. do the crush for the stone on top of uh-huh. the ground. And then you'd throw the rock in these quarry skips, and they had hooks on them. Mm-hmm. The truck would back up and have two cables that picked up this thing and took it over and backed up the ramp and dumped it into the crusher.
Okay.
Well, these old skip trucks, yeah. we were making tractors, mm-hmm. one tractor out of two because we didn't have enough money to buy the bars. Yeah. When we took all that stuff back into Durham, it looked like a Salvation Army pickup truck. We went from there. We were moving. We'd do well to move. Mm-hmm. We had a yard and a half northwest shovel. We did all the excavation. Mm-hmm. It was a gasoline shovel, not diesel.
Yeah.
We would move with that. If we moved 1,000 yards a day, we were doing real well. And talking about going from one extreme to the other. When we built Marine Air Base at Cherry Point, mm-hmm. and we would move 1,000 cubic yards an hour with the equipment we had down there.
Huh. Big change.
Yeah, quite a change.
And so you said you worked 12 years.
Well, I worked 12 years, and I came back to Waynesboro and started a little business of my own, mm-hmm. and I decided I didn't. I sold it. Somebody came yeah. along and wanted it worse than I did, so I went back to yeah. work with them again, and uh-huh. I worked. I'm one of the few people, I guess. The last job yes. I worked with Tier, I did most of the bidding.
Mm-hmm.
He had a son who was in school that I was, same time at Cherry uh-huh. Point. He was now old junior who just mm-hmm. died this week.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Anyhow, Mr. Tier had worked all over the eastern United States, mm-hmm. and I took everything north of the Mason-Dixon mm-hmm. line. Nello had everything south.
Oh.
Where were
you living then?
In Durham, primarily, but I was gone most of the time.
Right.
I traveled.
Yeah.
I averaged about 140,000 miles a year traveling. We had an airplane, twin-engine
yeah.
airplane.
Yeah.
I guess the only contractor I know mm-hmm. that's built a road in Cuba.
This is especially interesting to me.
I built a road in Cuba in 1951, just prior to Batista's, and I can't remember, Rain, uh-huh. I can't even remember the name of the president.
Right.
He was the only president, it seemed to me, 3 years.
Right.
But this is in Camagüey province, mm-hmm. which is in the center about 400 miles mm-hmm. east of Havana.
Hmm.
I say I could fly, we'd fly down to Key West and gas right. up and fly over to Cuba, and I uh-huh. had to stop in Havana and pay off the engineers. Literally. And then go on out to the job and okay. stay there 3 or 4 days. Town was I can't remember the name of the town.
Right.
But then he had uh-huh. 55,000 people and one automobile in town.
Mm-hmm. Huh. I'm from Maryland. I was wondering, though, who you were saying Mason-Dixon line, where you were.
Turn that thing off.
Okay. Let's see. Anything else you'd like to tell me about your experience? You've answered all my questions.
Well, of course.
Okay.
The balsam mounds, which were so inaccessible and higher, they had no roads on them. But in the Mitchell County area around Spruce Pine, the location was fortunate in that the people there had been in mica and feldspar business were able to help
right.
them. They were familiar with the drills and that, accessing yeah. very difficult places. Out in the Haywood and Jackson County areas, you had two extremely large logging companies, lumber companies.
Mm-hmm.
There was one company, Suncrest Lumber Company, mm-hmm. had a large sawmill at Lake Logan, which mm-hmm. is below this gap.
Okay.
And it burned, the mountains burned above that and got so hot that the mill itself burned, and part of that old mill is still in the bottom of Lake Logan.
Hmm.
The other thing that was pretty nice, the other mill that was, they had put, dug, cut out roads and laid part of the ties, the cross ties were in, for up to SoCo Gap back east or north through the Balsams and above Waynesville. On Balsam Gap, part of that had been, they had some logging roads which made it accessible to a lesser, to better degree than it would. Most of that area was, Parkway was built there with, on that section they had camps.
Okay.
I'm not as familiar with the section from Balsam Gap back as I am back to Wagon Road, because the rest of it I worked on practically all of it in some way. When I left here and went to work with Asher Contracting Company, we built several sections in later days. It was one of the sections from SoCo to Cherokee. And I don't know, we did a lot of small work around Roanoke. But the man that's probably the most interesting person that I ever ran across is a man named Troy Tina. He did most of the masonry work that was done on the parkway, Troy Tina.
Yes, everyone has mentioned this name.
It was Smith and Troy Tina to begin with, and then Smith and Troy Tina got unhappy and separated. And Brown, it became Troy Tina and Brown. Brown had been an inspector on the parkway.
Now, these were the Italian stonemasons?
A lot of those masons. Joe Troitina and I were real close forever. He never did learn how to speak good, but he could break your hand with his head with his hands. When he was 85 years old, he was still hard as a rock. But he snuck people in and on New Jersey coast. Masons came in illegally. During the period of time after he'd been here for 40 years then, when they put rock work in front of the House of Representatives. That's illegal. Immigrants did so. Did the rock stonework on that? And
that's funny.
When they got ready to get to, Joe just gave them Social Security numbers.
Right.
They had no Social Security. So when they got ready to retire, they had to pass a law. They had to go through all this rigmarole. I think there's about 8 or 10 of them that were involved getting for the children, particularly.
Right, right. That's interesting,
But they lived in a cabin, 10 of them, right at the gap where the parkway turns, where you turn off the road. They had a little old gasoline stove in there.
Hi, Sam.
Hey, Susan, how are you?
I was going to call you.
Okay. But Mr. Troitina was a good friend.
Yes.
That's nice to know.
You would go walk in there. I don't think they ever changed clothes. No. And they've been working on that pier and have grease and black. And frozen and come in there in that old oil stove and all. And what they didn't cook. I don't know. It's awful. Unbelievable.
Some conditions.
They knew how to do the rock work.
That's right. Yeah, I've heard that. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right.
As I say, I have a problem thinking about what happened yesterday. It's been pretty interesting to go back there.
It's been
a long time ago.
Thank you.